Yes, so Yathabhasa Yathatamaha, that is from the Chatushloki Bhagavatam, that it is a reflection in darkness, the darkness being our ignorance. Ignorance means an inability to see something, inability to understand or perceive something. So there's darkness. And then the material energy, as we saw yesterday, she is the deluding potency. So she fills out that darkness, or she casts a reflection into that darkness, which we take to be the reality. You see? So this is how everyone is deluded. So the material energy is a real energy, but she has a function to bewilder us. And when we are ignorant of Krishna, then she bewilders us. We become bewildered. You see, when we perceive the material nature, the effect on our consciousness is that we're totally bewildered. When one perceives Krishna behind the material energy, then he's no longer in ignorance. The darkness is not there. So then it's just like a projector, a film projector, any kind of projector. You need a dark room to create an image. If you turn on all the lights, you see, if that background of ignorance is not there, then you turn on the projector, what is the effect? You see, you're not bewildered by that. You don't become absorbed. You can't become... It may be a very interesting, exciting movie, but if all the lights are on and it's just a very dim projected image, and you're very aware that you're in a room with so many other objects and people, you can't become absorbed in that. You see, it doesn't have the effect that it would have if you turned off all the lights and you were sitting comfortably and you couldn't see anyone else, and then, you know, the film is playing very bright, then you'd become absorbed in it.
The
illusion is as I indicated before, it's identification. There's an English word, vicarious, to enjoy something vicariously. It means that, just again, to use the example of seeing a film, there's really nothing going on there to enjoy, you see. It's just a projected image of light and sound. But we look at it, it is what it is. That's all it is. It's just a projected image of light and sound. But when we look at it, we start to enjoy it vicariously. That is the illusion. We create that illusion. You see, there's Arnold Schwarzenegger, and there's, you know, Madonna, whoever, you know, actors who are popular today. And we view them and we start to identify, you know, the men think I'm Arnie, you know, I'm the hero, and the girls think I'm the heroine. And when they come together, embracing one another, then everyone gets, you know, sentimental. Oh, and when there's action, then everyone gets fired up. When there's danger, everyone's afraid. This is the illusion.
So that does not really exist.
That does not really exist. No, like Sachinanda Maharaj, you were telling in the Prasadam about how Srila Prabhupada, you tried to challenge him when this was before actually you joined. And you put this point, why does the Lord create Maya to keep us, that keeps us in illusion? And Prabhupada said, he doesn't create Maya, you create Maya. And this is how we create Maya. Because the material energy is the Lord's energy working, you know, in its own way, doing its own thing, as directed by the Lord. But we view this material energy in our ignorance, and we create all kinds of other meanings to it. Our desires come out, and we actually think we can satisfy our desires, which we have detached from Krishna in this material illusion. So that is Maya, and that is unreal, and that is our fault. Yes?
This is very thought-provoking what you present. I have a question to this verse 3, 10, 13. This cosmic manifestation as it is now, it was, this cosmic manifestation is as it is now, it was the same in the past, and it will continue in the same way in the future. Could you please explain the meaning of time here in this? Is there a deeper significance to what we understand time to be, like an impersonal representative of the Lord, which moves, which objectively moves material reality? Or is your question clear?
Yeah, I think so. There's an example which Prabhupada gives in another purport in Srimad Bhagavatam of electricity and a machine. So the material universe is a machine assembled as a machine is, so many gears and components which all fit together. And when the machine is plugged in, the electricity comes into it and energizes it, and then all the motions, the cosmic motions, the turning of the planets and everything begins. And then when it is unplugged, everything stops, and then the machine is disassembled and the parts are put on the shelf. And later on, it can be assembled again and plugged in again. So that current, that is the time energy, and that is a constant because it is the impersonal feature of the Lord. But sometimes it's plugged in, you see. Sometimes, and sometimes the plug is taken out. So as in our discussion on Pradhana yesterday, we saw how this whole material existence, Pradhan, and then the Prakriti, it all arises out of the Brahma Jyoti. And there's a purport, I think I handed, the purport was in the handout yesterday, in which Srila Prabhupada clearly explained that, how all the universes, everything can be understood to arise out of the impersonal Brahma Jyoti. This is the time energy, actually. This is what energizes the elements and gets them working, and all the cycle. We understand time according to the cycles, its effect actually, that we see the cycles of the heavens, the rising and setting of sun and moon and all this. This is the effect. Like an electric clock also. The motive force is actually the electricity, and the effect is the turning of the hands. All right, so shall we go on with another slippery argument? This is from the Anyaya and Vaisheshika camp. So you say, you meaning the devotees, say that the material nature is an emanation of the Supreme Lord. And you say that the jiva, the living entity, is also an emanation from the Supreme Lord. So in this way, your philosophy confuses the difference between the Lord and the jiva. Because they say this because the Nyaya and Vaisheshikas, they're also, as we saw with the Sankhya philosophers, they're very anti-monist. They do not say, they're against the position, in other words, that there is one absolute truth. The Sankhya philosophers say there's two absolute truths, two tattvas, Purusha Prakriti. As far as the Nyayas are concerned, they explain reality in 16 categories. The Vaisheshikas, they say there's 9 real substances and 7 real categories. So their philosophy gets very complex. And their view is that each one of these substances or categories exists in its own independent, real space. You know, it's a component of a total, but in itself, it exists as its own reality. And they also include, in both, these are seemingly theistic philosophies. So Ishvara is there, but don't be fooled by that because he's just another category. Yes, there is a God. He's existing over there. But he has nothing intrinsically to do with all the other categories. It's not that he is the source. They object to this view that he is the source. And here's their reasoning. If you say that the material nature and the jiva have emanated from the Lord, the material nature is an emanation from the Lord, and the jiva is an emanation from the Lord. And then within the material world, the jiva becomes bewildered by the material nature. Then how does this work, you see? What is the difference between the Lord and his emanation? You say, you know, you're actually confusing the whole issue. So now, the Bhagavatam, the three verses, the three last verses we're going to look at, very clearly explains the difference, the similarity and difference between the Lord and the living entity with regards to the creation. So first, Esha Nityo Vya Shukshma Esa Savashvaya Svadrik Atma Maya Gunayar Vishvam Atmanam Shujite Prabhu. The living entity is eternal and imperishable because he actually has no beginning and no end. He never takes birth or dies. He is the basic principle of all types of bodies, yet he does not belong to the bodily category. A living being is so sublime that he is equal in quality to the Supreme Lord. So hearing all this, you know, as this verse would be read to these philosophers, they would be going, yeah, that's what we mean. Where's the difference? But then, now here comes the difference. Nonetheless, because he is extremely small, he is prone to be illusioned by the external energy. And thus, he creates various bodies for himself according to his different desires. And the specific word, for those who would like to use this verse in their preaching, the specific word shukshma. Shukshma means very, very fine or not seen by the material eyes. This is the word shukshma, which means the living entity is very small. Very subtle or very small. From the purport, in this verse, the philosophy of achincha bheda bheda, simultaneous oneness and difference, is described. The living entity is eternal, nitya, like the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but the difference is that the Supreme Lord is the greatest, no one being greater to or equal than him, whereas the living entity is shukshma, or extremely small. The Shastra describes that the magnitude of the living entity is 1/10,000th the size of the tip of a hair. The Supreme Lord is all-pervading. Andantarastha paramano chayantarastham. Relatively, if the living entity is accepted as the smallest, there should naturally be inquiry about the greatest. The greatest is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the smallest is the living entity. Another peculiar characteristic of the jiva is that he becomes covered by maya. Atma maya gunaya. He is prone to become... to being covered by the Supreme Lord's illusory energy. The living entity is responsible for his conditional life in the material world, and therefore he is described as Prabhu, the Master. If he likes, he can come back to this material world, and if he likes, he can return home back to Godhead. The next verse is explaining more qualities of similarity between the Lord and the living entity. For this living entity, no one is dear, nor is anyone unfavorable. He makes no distinction between that which is his own and that which belongs to anyone else. He is one without a second. In other words, he is not affected by friends and enemies, well-wishers or mischief-mongers. He is only an observer, a witness of the different qualities of men. So this is another further similarity. Now, the third verse is pointing out the distinction, how the Lord is distinct from the living entity. The Supreme Lord, Atma, the creator of cause and effect, does not accept the happiness and distress that results from fruitive actions. He is completely independent of having to accept a material body, and because he has no material body, he is always neutral. The living entities, being part and parcel of the Lord, possess his qualities in a minute quantity. Therefore, one should not be affected by lamentation. From the purport, we should also understand that udasina, neutral, does not mean he takes no action. Rather, it means that he is not personally affected. For example, a court judge is neutral when two opposing parties appear before him, but still he takes action as the case warrants. This explanation is very, very important. because the Lord is Udasina, neutral. Now, the opposing philosophers, they understand that to mean, yeah, the Lord just becomes the material world and he becomes the living entities. In this sense, he has nothing else to do. He just becomes everything, and then the whole cosmic manifestation goes on. And he's entangled in it also. He has no separate identity. But this is not a fact. The Lord is the source of jiva and pradhana, but he is not affected by the creation that results from their combination. And Prabhupada gives this very nice example. A court judge is neutral when two opposing parties appear before him. So the opposing parties are the material nature and the living entity. Isn't it? You see, the living entity is situated on the machine built of the material energy. And this is the cause for his bondage, because he's associating with that which is opposite to him in quality. He's trying to control it and enjoy it. And the Lord is neutral, but he is situated there as a judge. His neutrality does not mean that he is just merged into the whole existence and is no longer discernible, is no longer distinct from living entity and matter. But he is the Paramatma, he is the judge of the living entity struggles with the material nature. So he's not involved, but yet he is directing. Is that clear? All right, so today we're a little ahead of time. That's nice.
It would be very nice. Sorry.
Yes.
It would be very nice if you could just. There is a very good. There is a thought flow in your presentation, which is very lofty. Could you just, for our convenience, just thread all together once again in a short summary, so to say.
Well, let's. It's here in the outline. I think we can consult with that.
Yeah. That's what we all have, or
is yes, everyone should have this. So the first point, A, the unreal asat is not the first cause. So in this section we're looking at what is sat, what is asat. So Krishna, first we explained how it is Krishna who is sat. He is eternally real. And he is the upadana karana, in his lila of creation, he is the ingredient cause. He is the substance of creation. So that is also sat, that is real. This is why it is said the unreal asat is not the first cause. First, the cause meaning the ingredient cause. It's not that it is unreal. It is real. So then we dealt with the argument, well, what happens, you see, the Vedas say this material existence, or this material manifestation, this cosmos, this jagat, is unreal. It says it's unreal. So what are you saying? What happens when the unreal is absorbed into the Lord? Does that mean he becomes unreal or defective? No. So that was dealt with that verse spoken by Prajapati Daksha, and the example of the canvas and the painting. And then finally, thirdly, we looked at what does asat really mean? So asat is actually also a name of Krishna too, because he's asat, he's unreal or unknown to the materialists. What they take to be asat is simply their own ignorance of the sat. And then that's further explained what asat means according to Srimad Bhagavatam. There was a series of verses. Again, saying that the Lord is the substance. And this also another thing, the substance is real. And also another thing is that the regular manifestation and maintenance and dissolution of the material existence is also real because it is eternally reoccurring. It is a lila of the Lord, so that is also real. But what is unreal is our unreal attachment to the ebb and flow of material existence. That's the only thing that is unreal. And then we just dealt with this point. Though Krishna is the material cause of creation, this does not mean he is a jiva soul. In other words, distinguishing, we looked at how the Bhagavatam distinguishes between the Lord, the living entity, and also the material nature. Yes?
I read once that Shri Prabhupada said that for one who's Krishna conscious, there is no matter, there is only spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the same substance as Ramajoki, or is it a transformed substance, or is there any difference?
Yeah. The energies of creation, they manifest out of the pradhan. So these are originally spiritual, but as I said, there's a twofold aspect. There's the aspect of the Lord performing his lila. From that point of view, as Prabhupada said, from Krishna's point of view, everything is spiritual. It is simply the Lord playing with his energies. But from our point of view, our meaning the conditioned souls who want to enjoy this material display, it is matter. It is this temporary, this miserable, this ignorant substance.
Which then does not ultimately exist.
Yes, well, that's a fact.
What
that's the
comment.
Her comment is which does not ultimately exist, and that is the Bhagavatam philosophy. Yes, that which we take to be matter does not exist. That is a fact. And one who is Krishna conscious can see that. But to be Krishna, to be on that platform means to be above the influence of the three modes of nature. And what are the three modes of nature? They are the modes of creation, maintenance, and destruction. That's what three modes are. So one who is above that.
Earth, water, fire, air, ether is ultimately not really a matter.
No. No, because... No, it's a fact. This is Vedanta philosophy. Vedanta philosophy explained. There's a very interesting verse or sutra, which is of course elaborated on very extensively by the Bhagavatam, because that's what the Bhagavatam is all about, the Lord's pastimes in the spiritual world. So the Vedanta sutra indicates that when one, it's very sublime, when one comes up to the Brahman platform, then one will see within Brahman. You see, it's like the build-up is like very, you can see, very attractive to the impersonalists, because it's the Brahman is being described as avyakta and full of light and all this and that. And then when one actually comes to the Brahman platform, then one will see within the Brahman the Gramya Bhuta. Gramya Bhuta, Gramya means village, literal word village, and Bhuta means elements. So this must be a real cold shower to the impersonalists, because the Vedanta Sutra says when you get up there, you're going to look inside, you're going to see a village. Of course, Vrindavan village. And within the village, you're going to see things which appear to be constructed out of Buddha's elements. There will be earth, there will be water, there will be fire. All the Buddhas will be there. And that's when the impersonalists, they go, wait a minute. They close the door. I'm getting back down to the material world. So actually the true form of earth, water, fire, air, all these elements is spiritual. Yes.
You will Someone would have to look it up in the folio program, but it was yesterday or before yesterday where I put up a book, Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Prabhupada says, in Goloka Vrindavan there is a spiritual form of the elements. Actually, I know where it is. In Sariputta's Vedic cosmography, he quotes Prabhupada saying such a thing. If you are interested, I can find it out and show it. It's really confirmed also in Prabhupada's writing that there is a spiritual form of these elements.
Yes. Yeah, there are Bhagavatam verses which declare the same points also. That these energies which we know in this world as material energies, they're arrayed around the Lord in Vaikuntha. Clearly says within Vaikuntha, those same energies are there as his devotees.
So there's a long discussion in Bhagavatamrita on that point, analyzing the energies. That the Lord is a personal form, the energies of persons arrayed around him.
Yes, Prabhupada.
How would you explain to the people the principles of the deity form and the replace of the Lord which are material?
The deity form? You mean what is manifested here? Manifested here. Yeah, well, we're out of time. And and it's, you know... Yeah, I would suggest that you go to Krishna Chaitanya's class and you ask him that question. He can give a very elaborate answer. I could also give an elaborate answer, but it's time to go now. And it kind of gets us a little, it's not really off the subject, but it gets us into a parallel universe, which I want to stay within this universe. So tomorrow, I hope our class will get very interesting because we start talking about Buddhism, the different schools of Buddhism, and that is completely mental. And the people that you meet today are completely mental. So there's a lot to learn from this for preachers in dealing with completely mental, self-contradictory positions. All right. Hare Krishna. See you tomorrow. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. So, today, we're going to get mental. We're going to look at Buddhism. Buddhism is an extremely influential philosophy in the East and in the West. Because Buddhism is very mental. And when people get on the mental plane and start to speculate, it seems inevitable that they'll end up with Buddhistic ideas, even if they've never read a book on Buddhism. They just follow the natural course of Buddhist thinking, because it is mental. So I want to begin with a brief explanation of the very basic points of Buddhist philosophy. And I'll tell you what you're responsible for. A lot of what I'm going to present now in this beginning of the class is really sense gratification, or, you know, because you're probably a little interested to know about it, but it's not material that you'll have to answer questions on. I'll tell you, there is upcoming in this presentation a section that I will ask questions on. It's very relevant to thought processes that we see today. So anyway, we'll begin here with what is Buddhism. So, you know, I think everybody knows basically what Buddhism is from Srila Prabhupada's books. I just want to make some points here that you may find useful. There are four basic tenets or principles in Buddhist philosophy. When we say, well, now we're speaking very generally because there are many branches of Buddhist philosophy. It gets very complex. But there is a basic platform on which all these different branches exist. So we're talking about the basic platform. So in all forms of Buddhism,
This is the first principle, dukkha, which you know means suffering. So dukkha, there is suffering. This is an existential statement about existence itself. Dukkha. It is full of suffering. The next point, samudaya. These are Buddhist terms. Suffering has a cause. So if suffering has a cause, then suffering can be removed. Next point, therefore, Nirodha. This is an important term to note. We'll be confronted with this a little later. Therefore, suffering can be destroyed. The word Nirodha means literally annihilation. This word also appears in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and we'll be seeing a verse about this. And then finally, fourth point, Marga, which means path. There is a path. There is a path out of suffering. And that is a path taught by the Buddha. And in essence, this path, then in Buddhist teachings, then they speak of the fourfold noble path and eightfold this and that. You know, it gets more and more complex. But in essence, what this marga means, it boils down to ahimsa, shunyata. If you know these two terms, you know all that there is to know about Buddhism in essence. Ahimsa means non-violence. Shunyata means extinction of the self. So in other words, while in the world, one should practice ahimsa, and this will lead to shunyata, extinction of the self. And that shunyata, in other words, that means nirodha, again, nirodha. Suffering can be destroyed when self is extinguished. Yes?
So that the idea is that ahimsa alone is perfectly practiced, leads to shunyata.
Yeah, in all the practices of Buddhism, there is a eightfold method. But it comprises of activities and thought and ways of speech and so on. But it all culminates in this one thing, one doctrine of ahimsa. If one is a perfect Buddhist, then one is perfectly non-violent. Because I don't like to elaborate too much on Buddhist philosophy. But the idea is that, you see, you are suffering, and all other living entities are suffering. So if you become a perfect, non-violent person, and you're no longer causing them to suffer, then you will no longer have to suffer. That will lead you to shunyata. All right. So this is, I said, this is just for information's sake. You're not going to be tested on any of this material. This is just to help us understand. So what we've seen here is that Buddhist philosophy simply deals with material existence and its negation. That's all. That's all it's about. Now, may I erase this? Now we will come to
to four schools of Buddhism, which are dealt with in the Vedanta Sutra, which are, these schools are explained by Baladeva Vidyabhusa. I'll put the proper names of these schools. You're not responsible for them, but then I will put in English terminology their philosophical outlook, and this is what you're responsible for. So, the first school, Vaibhasika. Then, Sautrantika. Then, Yogacara. Then, Vaibhasika, Sautrantika, Yogacara, Madhyamika.
Someone may want to know, well, what about Zen? Or some other popular form of Buddhism.
These are four original schools of Buddhist philosophy. And from out of these, there came so many later on. Like the Zen comes out of Madhyamika after it went to China and got mixed with Taoism. And all, you know, there's a whole history of that. But we're just talking about the original four schools of Buddhism. Now here comes their philosophical standpoints, and this is what I want you to know. All right. Direct realism, representationalism, subjective idealism, voidism. Now, these are important
because, as I said, Buddhism is pure mental impure mental speculation. And when people speculate, when people get on the mental platform, then they will actually speculate through these phases. You'll find in Western philosophy the same points of view under different names, under different guises, because these are simply we can say stopping points of the mind on its endless journey to nowhere.
And they're related. Now I'm going to explain the relationship. So in the Vaibhasika school, Buddhism began with this viewpoint, direct realism, which simply accepts the world as it is, at face value. This is what is, just as you see it. This is all there is. Of course, Buddhism is completely materialistic. There is no transcendental reality beyond this world. So what you see, what you perceive with your senses, is what you get. That's all there is here. So fine. And as you know, there are many people who think like this. But then there's a problem. Why are we suffering? So then came up to try to explain why we're suffering. Then Sautrantika philosophy, they came up with this idea, representationalism, which means, all right, there is an internal reality, or an internal aspect, and that's the mind, that's the subtle aspect. And it's out of harmony with the external reality, because it gets attached. You see, the world is passing by, going through its changes, and the problem is that our minds become attached to the external forms of things, and we don't want them to change. But they change anyway, and therefore we suffer. So, then, the next phase, Yogacara, subjective idealism. This is to answer the problem, the philosophical problem that arises. Well, why Why should that be? Why should, if externally there's matter and internally there's matter, why should the internal matter become attached to the external matter? Why should that be? So then the Yogacara Buddhists, they tried to explain this with a doctrine of subjective idealism, which is that the only thing that really exists is our own consciousness. And everything that we're perceiving is a creation of that consciousness. In other words, we're dreaming. We're all having a dream. Or, to take it to extreme, there's a Western version of the same philosophy called solipsism. It's from the Latin, which means, solips means the self, solus, or alone. We get the word soul from that, solus, alone. So I alone exist. According to this point of view, in this room, in this world, I am the only person that actually exists. I'm sorry to tell you. The rest of you are just figments of my imagination. So, Yogacara Buddhism says, all that exists in truth is consciousness, my own consciousness. And everything else is a dream, an imagination springing out of my mind. And the problem is that I'm thinking of that as real. And I'm striving to enjoy that dream of mine. And that is what has caused the suffering. And finally, the Madhyatmika position is a position of total frustration with all philosophical points of view. Because obviously the weakness of the Yogacara position, very obvious, if everything is my dream, then why did I have to dream something so rotten? Why can't I dream something nice? Why can't I dream that, you know, I'm God and actually realize it if everything is just my dream? So the Madhyatmika position is, you know, to hell with philosophy. Everything is just void. And from this you get the Zen Buddhists who just, you know, say that they say things like, if you want to know the truth, then stare at a blank wall for 12 years. And you'll just see it somehow. You know, they're the ones who they have these mental exercises. What is the sound of one hand clapping? It follows no logic anymore, because logic is frustrating. So these are the schools of early Buddhism. Now, we want to turn to the Srimad Bhagavatam. We're not going to get into a comprehensive refutation of each one of these points of view. We don't have time for that. I just wanted to introduce them to you. And, you know, if you can just pick up what they're about, it can help you in understanding when you meet people, speculators, you know, where they're at. You know, if you can actually learn this, you'll see, you'll quickly understand who is, by talking to them, who's a subjective idealist, who's a voidist, who's a representationalist, and who's a direct realist. They're very convenient categories. So, now, we're going to turn to Srimad Bhagavatam on the outline you have, or let's just look at the handout I gave you. The verse on the first page, 1087:19. So, the Buddhists, they completely ignore spirit. They see everything in terms of matter only. So, this verse, 1087:19, is very nicely explaining that there is a spiritual essence to everything. So I'll read the translation. Apparently entering among the variegated species of living beings you have created, you inspire them to act, manifesting yourself according to their higher and lower positions. Just as fire manifests differently according to the shape of what it burns. Therefore, those of spotless intelligence, who are altogether free from material attachments, realize your undifferentiated, unchanging self to be the permanent reality among all these impermanent life forms. So Buddhism views this world as being
inherently, essentially impermanent. The Buddhist view of permanence, any idea of permanence, is rejected in Buddhism. There is no such thing. So Bhagavatam says, no, someone who thinks that way is not enlightened in terms of this verse. Those of spotless intelligence who are altogether free from material attachments realize your undifferentiated, unchanging self to be the permanent reality among all these impermanent life forms. Now, from the purport. Even in the midst of material creation and destruction, the Lord of all creatures remains eternally unchanged, as expressed here by the word ekarasam. In other words, the Lord eternally maintains his personal form of immeasurable, unalloyed spiritual pleasure. Ekarasa. Rasa, of course, means spiritual pleasure. So this is very, very interesting. Ekarasa. So there is a reality, a permanent reality beyond the impermanent forms of this world. And the nature of this reality is spiritual bliss. Ekarasa. There is one eka, one reality, one absolute reality, and it is full of rasa, full of bliss. Now, in Buddhism, the exact opposite premise is made. That there, yes, there is one reality, just like we're starting with Vaidya Sika, direct realism. There is a reality, but that reality is material, not spiritual. And it is dukkha. It is full of suffering instead of being full of rasa. So, now, then the question can be asked. If we are one, according to Buddhism, if we are one, and we have to remember what this oneness means, that the self is actually just matter, therefore we're not actually living conscious beings at all. Our individuality as persons is just an illusion, has no existence once whatsoever. So if we are one, or in other words, if there is just matter and no real individual life at all, then why should we suffer? Why should there be suffering? Now, Srila Prabhupada put the question in this way. That if a lump of chemicals, you have a lump of chemicals, or a bag of chemicals, and it falls to the ground with a big crash, why should it suffer? Because people say, materialistic people say, that we are matter. The body is just a lump of chemicals, and that's all we are. So Prabhupada asked the question, if you take a lump or a bag of chemicals and drop it on the floor, it is not suffering, because it is just matter. So if that's all we are, if that's all that exists is matter, then why should there be suffering? Why should there be the perception of suffering? So according to Srimad Bhagavatam, it takes two to suffer. Suffering arises out of duality, not oneness. The condition of oneness, ekarasa, it is blissful. This is the absolute platform of Krishna consciousness, where everything is one in harmony with the transcendental desires of the Supreme Lord. His devotees are one with him, as Srila Prabhupada explained, by serving his desires. This is the Vaishnava explanation of oneness. So when there is a different desire, then suffering arises. And that is explained in the next verse, which I note here was not numbered. So the number is also on your outline. Bhayam dvitiya binivesiyatcha. This is a very famous verse. This is from Canto 11, Chapter 2, Text 37. And here we have in one verse a very concise and yet extremely profound explanation of the origin of suffering. When the living entity is attracted by the material energy, which is separate from Krishna, he is overpowered by fear. Because he is separated from the Supreme Personality of Godhead by the material energy, his conception of life is reversed. What does that mean, reversed? Real life means eternality. It means knowledge. It means bliss. The Buddhists say real life means everything is temporary, full of ignorance, full of suffering. Their conception of life is reversed because they have become separate. Because they, as this in the Sanskrit, dvitiya. Absorbed. Dvitiya abhivinivesita. Because they are absorbed in something other than the Lord. They are separate. They have become distinct from the spiritual world. So there is two, not one. In other words, instead of being the eternal servant of Krishna, he becomes Krishna's competitor. This is called Vipariyo Smriti. To nullify this mistake, one who is actually learned and advanced worships the Supreme Personality of Godhead as his spiritual master, worshipful deity, and source of life. He thus worships the Lord by the process of unalloyed devotional service. Now, in the next section of verses, from the 11th canto, 11th chapter, texts 5 through 8, the two-ness, the duality, is explained in very precise terms. So we can just read the translations. Thus, my dear Uddhava, in the same material body we find opposing characteristics such as great happiness and misery. This is because both the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is eternally liberated, as well as the conditioned soul, are within the body. I shall now speak to you about their different characteristics. By chance, two birds have made a nest together in the same tree. The two birds are friends and are of a similar nature. One of them, however, is eating the fruits of the tree, whereas the other, who does not eat the fruits, is in a superior position due to his potency. The bird who does not eat the fruits of the tree is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who by his omniscience perfectly understands his own position and that of the conditioned living entity, represented by the eating bird. That living entity, on the other hand, does not understand himself or the Lord. He is covered by ignorance and is thus called eternally conditioned, whereas the Personality of Godhead, being full of perfect knowledge, is eternally liberated. So, when we from out of this contemplation of the origin of suffering comes a very interesting argument for the existence of the Supreme Lord. And that is that our suffering condition, and I'm speaking very generally, embracing anyone who knows that he's suffering, any halfway intelligent person, doesn't have to be a devotee, but just someone who is aware, I'm suffering. So he understands, we understand our suffering in terms of our imperfection. I think everyone would agree with that. It's a very logical statement. Because I am imperfect in so many ways, or incomplete, there is some great lack here and there in my life. Therefore, I'm suffering. So because of this, then when we think about how to become free of suffering, we are obliged to think about perfection. We're obliged to consider the state of perfection, which is a state certainly transcendental to our present position. So what I'm saying is that in the suffering condition we are imperfect, or because we are imperfect, we are suffering. And as soon as we contemplate how to get out of suffering, we have to think about perfection. And Krishna, in these verses that we've just read, explains why. Because within this body, there is both perfection and imperfection. Because there is the Paramatma and the Atma. So long as the Atma thinks that he's alone, and that he is the Lord, enjoyer, controller of material nature, he suffers. And in that suffering condition, he's forced to think about his imperfections. You see, people are working so hard in this world to make up for their imperfections. I don't have enough money. I'm not beautiful enough, so I should get my hair styled. I'm not dressed nicely enough. And so on and so forth. They're struggling to try to perfect themselves. Or in the spiritual realm, this is an example of persons who are striving for material perfection. In the spiritual department, then the people are practicing yoga or, you know, different types of self-improvement processes, all striving for perfection. So from where does this conception of, this intuition of perfection arise? It's because within this body, there is the perfect being, the Paramatma, who is Ekarasa, who is full of all bliss. And as we saw yesterday, and also today, in today's verses, the same thing is indicated, but in the last verses we read yesterday, the living entity, the individual soul, he shares the qualities of the Paramatma. That's why he's drawn by instinct to strive for perfection, because his qualities are the same. But what is the difference? As we saw yesterday, he is shukshma, he's very small. Because of his smallness, he can be separated due to Maya's influence. And this way he falls down into suffering. So this point comes very clear in the next verse. Dehoshto pina dehoshto. One who is enlightened in self-realization, although living within the material body, sees himself as transcendental to the body, just as one who has arisen from a dream gives up identification with the dream body. A foolish person, however, although not identical with his material body, but transcendental to it, thinks himself to be situated in the body, just as one who is dreaming sees himself as situated in an imaginary body. This second part of the verse is actually describing the Buddhist position, that they actually equate the self with the body. And therefore, existence to them just means dukkha, suffering, only suffering. So in Buddhism, there is no scope for transcendence because there's only one. But their conception of oneness is this material existence. That's all that exists. So this sense of self, this one, this self, has to be destroyed. This is the Buddhist position. Destroy the self, and then only will suffering end, when everything is extinguished. Now, we come to the next point, dealing with an objection. A Buddhist may reply, no. Buddha explained the cause of suffering very precisely, without touching your doctrine of duality. He explained it as a wheel of causation. In Buddhism, this symbol, it's on the flag of India too. They have this symbol, this wheel with many, many spokes. Wheel of causation. And with this example, they attempt to explain the origin of suffering. So, they give the picture of a wheel, which is ever turning. And this wheel has 12 spokes, which represent 12 phases of causation, beginning with avidya, ignorance. And then it develops. I don't think we have to go into these 12 phases. I'm not going to test you on it, and if I explain them, it would take a long time and probably put some of you to sleep. So it starts with avidya, or ignorance. And then it ends with the 12th one is Jara Marna, which means old age and death. The one before that, the 11th one, is Jati, birth. And then in between there are simply different stages of material development of consciousness. Now, this explanation of the wheel is very strange, actually. Because the Buddhist view changed. This is a wheel of change. And the Buddhists explain change, they explain the phenomenal changing of this world by a philosophy of spontaneous, ever-changing equilibrium. It's something like when you view the waves on an ocean, one wave is coming up, one wave is going down, just randomly coming up, coming down. And in this way, everything's changing, but everything's staying the same. They use the analogy of a stream of events, like a stream flowing. And a stream is just carrying things, you know, a leaf, a stick, this, that. It's just flowing by. And the stream is always there, and yet at the same time, on the surface, there's so much change going on. And it's random. It's random. So the Buddhists use this explanation to justify this analogy of a wheel of 12 spokes. First, there's avidya. And then avidya, just like a wave, it comes up and then it disappears. And then it's replaced by the next, which is samskaras, past impressions, and then on and on and on. It's not that there's a logical set pattern that's being followed. It's just that spontaneously avidya comes and then it's followed by the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. So this is how they explain suffering in this world, because these things are happening, finally resulting in birth, old age, and death. Therefore, we suffer. Now, I have included a verse here, Canto 8, Chapter 5, Text 28. I'll read the translation. In the cycle of material activities, the material body resembles the wheel of a mental chariot. The 10 senses, 5 for working and 5 for gathering knowledge, and the 5 life airs within the body form the 15 spokes of the chariot's wheel. The 3 modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance, are its center of activities, and the 8 ingredients of nature, earth, water, fire, air, sky, mind, intelligence, and false ego, comprise the rim of the wheel. The external material energy moves this wheel like electrical energy. Thus, the wheel revolves very quickly around its hub or central support, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the Super Soul and the Ultimate Truth. We offer our respectful obeisances unto Him. I have a question for you all, or for someone, one of you. Can you explain how this verse refutes this Buddhist idea of this wheel of change?
It just describes the body, and beyond the body there is the soul, the super soul. So this is just describing one aspect of reality, which the Buddhists consider the whole reality.
Yeah, that's correct. But I want to go into this analogy, because if we go into the analogy of the wheel, both in this verse we have the analogy of a wheel, and the Buddhist explanation of the origin of suffering, we have a wheel analogy also. Now there's something in this verse which is very outstanding, which is very different, which actually completes the imagery and makes it sensible. Yes, the central support is the super soul. Because if you have a wheel, see, the Buddhist philosophy doesn't make any sense. Because they say there's no underlying support. There's just this, it's
Yeah, it's like a dream, you know. It's just an ever-changing phantasmagoria. And yet they say there are 12 phases of change, and they're always repeating. It's a cycle of 12 that's always repeating again and again and again. Now if there's no, as the Buddhists say, no reality beyond this illusion, then why should these 12 phases repeat one after another? It's in the analogy of a wheel. A wheel has to turn, and to turn it requires a basis, a hub, a central point. And then it turns. But the Buddhists don't allow that. The Buddhists don't allow any central point. And the Buddhist explanation of the turning of the wheel is, I mean, it's incomprehensible, actually. It means they're more or less saying that this spoke is here, and then it disappears. And then it appears here, and the spoke that was here appears there. And this way the wheel turns.
Something like a movie film. You see, which consists of a series of still pictures. And when you run it by fast, then you get the appearance of motion. But this analogy also doesn't support Buddhism, because to make that film run, you require so many other arrangements. But their visualization is as if you have a movie film that's just kind of turning in space by itself, spontaneously. So their position doesn't make sense. From the purport, the entire world is going on because the living entity, who is part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, is utilizing the material energy. Under the clutches of the material energy, the Jivatma is revolving on the wheel of birth and death under the direction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The central point is the Supersoul. As explained in Bhagavad Gita 18:61, the Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, O Arjuna, and is directing the wanderings of all living entities who are seated as on a machine made of the material energy. The material body of the living entity is a result of the conditioned soul's activities, and because the supporter is the Supersoul is the true reality. Each one of us, therefore, should offer respectful obeisances to this central reality. One should not be misguided by the activities of this material world and forget the central point, the absolute truth. That is the instruction given here by Lord Brahma. So, is that clear? Now, we will go on. We're going
to
just
make an attempt even to, in their analogy, say something about the hub.
No, the hub is a no-no. That is not allowed in Buddhism. There is no basis. Because this world is Maya only. And their definition of Maya means that it is ultimately a dream, unreal. So they give this, you know, they try to explain things cleverly, like with this analogy of a turning wheel to show that their philosophy is very complex. But there's nothing behind it. It has no support. It's just a wheel turning, as I say, in a very strange way, with spokes disappearing and reappearing. And this way the wheel is turning. So the next point we want to cover, the last point in today's session, it is called destruction and liberation. You'll recall that in Buddhism, Nirodha, destruction, annihilation, is the path of release, is the method of release, to destroy the self. The self is Maya. So when the conception of selfness is removed and there's nothing left, then that is liberation. So based upon And actually the Buddhists, they have processes of meditation. Prabhupada explained that they in their minds, they break everything down. They view this world and they break it down, break it down, break it down, till finally they have atoms, and then behind the atoms, the void, and then finally they meditate on the void. So, again, their view is that ultimately there is only nothingness. So they're actually anxious for Nirodha, total destruction. This is their goal. Now, based on what we learned yesterday about Sadasat, what is their mistake here? Yesterday we spoke of annihilation or destruction when the universe is dissolved. Because, you see, I'll tell you, the Buddhists in their philosophy, when they actually, their view is quite interesting, that an individual person can destroy the universe, not for everyone else, but for himself. when he becomes a perfect Buddhist, then he destroys the universe. And then there's, you know, for himself. And then he's free. Now, what's wrong with that? Yes. Well, illusion. Yeah, for those who are in illusion, then the material world is eternal. But that's just illusion. No, but I'm asking a question from yesterday's discussion. We spoke extensively on manifestation and non-manifestation. Yes, Maharaj.
The example of the canvas and the painting was given. When the painting is scraped off, the canvas still remains.
Yes.
So Krishna, who is the cause of all causes, he remains eternally unaffected by manifestation and non-manifestation of his material.
Yeah. The Lord's energies are eternal. The Lord plays with them. He manifests them in different ways, and then he deconstructs them and brings them back into himself. But nothing is actually destroyed in essence, because the Lord is Sat. He is eternal. He is true reality. And his energies are also Sat. So the Buddhists, their philosophy is that everything is actually ultimately Asat or unreal. But yesterday we learned, what is the meaning of Asat? It just means that from time to time, this material manifestation becomes invisible. Not that it's not there. It's just that it is invisible. Sometimes manifest, sometimes non-manifest. So, I'm building this... Yeah?
Could it be said that the Buddhists, because we understand everyone is attracted, you know, ultimately to Krishna, so... their ultimate purpose of shunya, becoming void, isn't it actually, in a sense, to merge into pradhan, just as the...
Well, the Prabhupada says, yeah.
Merge into pranajana.
Yes, Srila Prabhupada says that's where they go. Because as we heard in the day before, Shukadeva Goswami describes the pradhan with the term shunya, void. So that is the void. But it is not actually void. It's just the inconceivable material energy which we're unable to, when you come, if you somehow are able to approach the pradhana, it's just beyond our powers of perception and understanding. So it appears to us to be void, but it is not actually void. So now, this Bhagavatam verse 2:10:16. This is a very interesting verse, because it is, this is on the real page 5. You've marked page 2:10:16. Very interesting verse, because it could be taken as a direct reply to the Buddhists, because you find the first word is Nirodho. These are definitions of what is destruction and what is liberation. So the merging of the living entity, this is a translation, the merging of the living entity along with its conditional living tendency with the mystic lying down of the Mahavishnu is called the winding up of this cosmic manifestation. That, in other words, is Nirodha. That is Nirodha. Liberation, mukti, This is a famous, this couplet of lines, second couplet, is often quoted by Prabhupada. Muktir hitvanyata rupam svarupena vivastita. Liberation is the permanent. This is anathema to the Buddhists. Permanent? Oh no. But here it is. Liberation is the permanent situation of the form of the living entity after he gives up the changeable, gross, and subtle material bodies. From the purport. So, after the winding up of the cosmic manifestation, most of the conditioned souls merge into the existence of the Mahavishnu, personality of Godhead, lying in his mystic slumber, to be created again in the next creation. That is the defect of their philosophy. They aspire for the shunya, for the void, but they place themselves in the pradhan, and they will be created again. But some of the conditioned souls who follow the transcendental sound in the form of Vedic literatures and are thus able to go back to Godhead attain spiritual and original bodies after quitting the conditional and gross, subtle material bodies. And then Prahlad Maharaj, in the next verse, we find using this wheel analogy, we find a very nice explanation of what is nirvana, the extinction of material existence. That's on the real page 6, which is after page 7, which comes next. So turning 2 pages ahead, here's the translation. The real problem of life is the repetition of birth and death, which is like a wheel rolling repeatedly up and down. This wheel, however, completely stops when one is in touch with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In other words, by the transcendental bliss realized from constant engagement in devotional service, one is completely liberated from material existence. All learned men know this. Therefore, my dear friends, O son of the Asuras, immediately begin meditating upon and worshipping the Super Soul within everyone's heart. The Super Soul, who is the hub of that turning wheel, the central point. And in the purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, this cessation of all material happiness is called nibriti or nirvana. So this is the Srimad Bhagavatam explanation of the wheel of birth and death. You can easily see from all this how Buddhism is, all they've done is gone through the Vedas and snipped apart here and snipped apart there and put it together, hey presto, a new philosophy. Which is very imperfect when it is analyzed from the original philosophy, the Bhagavad philosophy. One can see its failings very clearly. So we have 5 minutes left. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Yes, my question of Prabhupada states that the cessation of all material happiness is called nibriti or nirvana, but also suffering.
Yeah. Sukha, dukkha, suffering or happiness and suffering, they're inseparable in the material world. If you say material happiness, you're actually only talking about suffering. But what Prabhupada means here is that this wheel is of birth and death is kept turning because people pursue happiness. This is why they stay in the material world, because they want material happiness. This is like the carrot you see in front of the ass smelling the carrot, always moving forward. Yes.
But Buddha was a Vishnu avatar, so it is a trick to get certain people who don't believe in God to get them into a certain process. But it is not, they don't go for liberation because they come back. So it is partial, actually. It is not.
Yeah.
Going on the ladder, they go up.
Yes.
They have to come back, and is there then do they come in a higher position then to go up, or where they come when they come back?
Well, if they attain the pradhan, that is almost attaining Brahman. So it is almost impersonal liberation. So it is a very high state. But it is very difficult to attain that. Srila Prabhupada explains the mission of Buddha is to trick the atheist to follow him. He taught this philosophy, which is just illusion, because these people were illusioned. They could not accept God. They were atheists. So by preaching this philosophy, what he accomplished was to get them to follow him. And Prabhupada said, by worshipping the Buddha, the person Buddha, in this way they became attached to a form of the Lord. This is the meaning of the Buddha, or Lord Vishnu, tricking them. So this entering into the pradhan, it might happen to a very few Buddhists, but as you see, I've visited Buddhist countries, and the people know that that process is so difficult. It is, I mean, they don't even try for it. That's why in the Buddhist monasteries, you become a monk for 3 months or, you know, a year. That's the system. That's their monastic system. Yes, come on, come on. And you want to be a monk for 3 months or 3 weeks, that's fine. You'll get good karma for that. And then when you want to leave, yeah, we understand. You can't stay. That's who can stay. So they come and go like that. So, and you can see in the Buddhist countries, they're very, the people, yeah, they worship. Yeah, they worship Buddha. The common people just worship the form of Buddha, just as we worship the form of Krishna. And they hope for Buddha's mercy. Yeah. And they give donations to the monks for pious activity. That's really what Buddhism is. Yes?
That verse in Bhagavad Gita, second chapter, where Krishna says, even if you think the soul is always coming and going, still there's no reason to lament. If I remember correctly, Prabhupada, in the Purport, refers to that as a Buddhist understanding.
Vaibhasika. The term Lokayata and Vaibhasika, these two terms. So Lokayata refers to the Charvak philosophy of Charvak Muni, philosophy of sense enjoyment. This is also a voidist or philosophy, but they accent sense gratification. They say, since everything doesn't mean anything anyway, you might as well enjoy. It's like, you know, Rajneesh today. Yes, everything is void, but enjoy it. And the Vaibhasika is the other way, is accepting this world, material world, is all in all. Our existence in it must be stopped. So these are the two ways one can go with this type of philosophy. Yes, Maharaj?
In your outline, you said Sunyavada refuted in one verse.
That's tomorrow.
Aha, good.
Yes.
So yesterday you made an argument about how the living entities and the material energy both emanate from the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't understand that argument. I've been not
explained. Yeah. Well.
I don't understand what the problem is.
Well, the problem is that these philosophers, they don't understand the Lord to be transcendental to His energies. They take it, Prabhupada gave an example. You have a piece of paper, and if you make an emanation from it, it means you tear a piece off the paper, and then the paper is less. And so if you say that material nature and the jivas come from the Lord, they emanate from Him, then the Lord can't be left. The Lord won't be left after these emanations come out. So then what is He? You make Him into a jiva because you say the material nature is an emanation and the jiva is, so you turn the Lord into a jiva. And then these Sankhyas and Nyayas and Vaisheshikas, you see, they have their categories. So we keep the Ishvara in a category, you see. They'll even say, we're more theistic than you people because we have a nice category for God. And we keep him there. But the thing is that category is not the omnipotent Supreme Lord. It's just a kind of, you know, background shadowy figure. Like in the Vaisheshika philosophy, they say, the Lord, he causes the atoms to start moving, you see. that's what he does. he releases the atoms and they start moving, and then everything else just happens, you know, by, and the Lord has nothing to do with it. So that, you know, this is what we have a place for the Lord, and all the other energies are working, and he's not involved in that. He's distinct from it. But you say these energies come from him. So if they come from him, then he, once they emanate from him, then he's depleted. You see, he just becomes merged with the totality of creation. And then we explained how the Lord being neutral in the midst of creation does not mean that he's just merged with everything. But he's like the judge, the witness. That was a very nice example of the two opposing parties, the jiva and the material nature, in the courtroom, and they come before the judge. And the judge is aloof. He's aloof from their squabble, their argument, their problem they're having together. Yes? We're actually out of time.
Just a short question regarding yesterday's question. You said that that what Monday people call Asa is separated reality. So it's a proper to think that this is separated reality because it's sad, because the basis of this is the Lord, and the Monday people, they cannot just perceive it.
Yeah, it can be easily understood by this, again, this example of the thread and the woven cloth. The thread is the separate reality. It's woven together to form a cloth, which is only temporary, the temporary manifestation. And then when it's unraveled, when that cloth is torn apart, you have the threads again. So, but when people look at woven cloth, they don't think of the threads. You see, they see only the cloth. So similarly, when people look at this world, they cannot see the underlying reality. That's why it said it's a separate reality. Because they can, it's, the reality is separate from their perception, in other words. Yes, yes, I am just ending, but they're harassing with so many questions.
Yes, Vaishik has said there is an Ishvara, which is material, who's material, of course.
They're Buddhists. Yeah. Vaisheshika philosophers, right. the atomists.
I'm sorry.
We didn't talk much about them. Jai. This class comes to an end. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So, we're continuing in the middle of yesterday's handout. I do have a handout for the next class, but I'll only hand it out today if we get that far. Yesterday we were speaking, I didn't give the proper name, but this is the Buddhist conception of causation. And this is the proper name. I'm speaking a little more about this today. Pratitya Samutpada, which means conditioned co-production. this is this concept I explained, giving the example of spontaneous movements of waves. So in this idea, a cause is always the result of a previous cause, or let us say, a cause is an effect of a previous cause. They give the example of a seed. A seed is a cause of a tree, but a seed is an effect of a tree before. And then when you put that seed in the ground, that seed sprouts, then the seed no longer exists. The sprout exists. And when the tree grows up, then the sprout no longer exists. The tree. So in this is their idea of causation, that a cause is simply the result of a previous effect. And as soon as that cause creates another effect, then that cause doesn't exist anymore. So things go on as a kind of endless stream without any actual logical, or we could say real, connection between them. Just things happening one after the other. Now we spoke of this wheel. We're just summarizing the Buddhist conception of causation as a wheel turning in a very incomprehensible way without a hub. And there was this interesting point, I'd just like to repeat it, that they explain the development of material existence in 12 phases, 12 stages. And one replaces the other in sequence, in order, from 1 to 12, and then goes back to the original 1 again, avidya. In this way, the wheel is turning without end. But because of this philosophy, this idea of pratitya samutpada, then this idea of a wheel doesn't make sense. You see? Because things are